Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Carla, Grievous, Wick, and Clegg have left the Cutlass in the company of the Duke's commissioner in Maipur, Brendan Montrose, to visit his home for a rest and a meal before setting off on their journey to the Abbey. Chapter 3. Montrose's carriage was wider than those used in Kohane, able to seat 4 people comfortably. Carla supposed that was a result of Maipur's wider roads. Wick volunteered to sit up front next to the driver, and Clegg grinned as he bounced up and down on the padded seats, enjoying the luxury. "How long before we can set out for the Abbey?" Carla asked Montrose.
"Well, getting horses and supplies for the 4 of you won't take very long," said the commissioner as the carriage started off. "Like as not, you could be on your way in the early afternoon."
"How long will it take us to get there?" Grievous asked. "We had estimated 1, perhaps 2 days."
Montrose was startled at Grievous's accent. Carla sighed. "I suppose it's as good a time as any for a proper introduction. Commissioner, I'm not the only one who's under disguise here. May I present Captain Caius Grievous, Imperial Navy, retired."
Montrose's eyes widened even further.
"Grievous? I've heard that name. Sir, you are aware that the Fanes have put the word about that they'd pay well for news of you?"
"They are here ahead of us?" Grievous asked.
"Not the ones in Kohane," Carla said. "Like as not, these are cousins who received orders months ago from Drax and Fane to be on the lookout for you." She glanced at Montrose. "Am I right?"
Montrose nodded.
"The head of the family here in Maipur is Auric Fane, nephew of Draxon."
"How powerful are they here?"
"Well, they don't have the sort of dominance they enjoy in Kohane," Montrose explained. "On its own, Auric's family doesn't have any more wealth or power here than several other merchant families, but the others are always uncertain how far they can push Auric before Draxon takes notice and lends his nephew aid, either financially or in other ways." Montrose chuckled. "It's a two-edged sword, though. Gaining the attention of Draxon Fane isn't always something his relatives look forward to. Auric's father, for example, one day just disappeared. There were rumors that he'd been building a power base to challenge Draxon for the leadership of the family, and Draxon found out. Auric seems to have taken that lesson to heart."
The commissioner leaned back in his seat and looked out the window.
"Of course, there were other rumors that Auric was the one who told Draxon what his father was planning."
"Nothing about the Fane surprises me," Grievous said in a disgusted tone.
"Well, whether it's true or not, that's all the more reason to keep a low profile and just get out of this city as soon as we can," Carla said.
"Indeed," Grievous added. "But to repeat my original question, how long would it take to get there?"
"With horses, you should only have to make camp once," Montrose said. "Leaving Maipur around noon, with no delays on the road, you should get to the Abbey late afternoon the next day, a little over a day in total."
"Delays?" Carla asked, turning away from the window. "Do we have to watch for bandits?"
"Bandits? Oh, no. I shouldn't think you'll cross paths with any bandits. There's no bandits along that road these days."
"Why not?"
"It's become unprofitable for them," Montrose replied.
He grinned at Carla's puzzled expression.
"It's the pilgrims."
Now Grievous looked puzzled. Carla wondered if the word was unfamiliar to him. Maybe they don't have anything like pilgrims down in the Empire.
"Pilgrims," Clegg muttered. "Drown it all. What's that lot doing down here in the freeze?"
"What pilgrims always do," Carla put in, "travel somewhere that's important to them." She looked at Montrose. "In this case, it's the Abbey?" She already knew this from the little Tesca had told her, but she wanted to get Montrose's local perspective.
"Yes, they are," the commissioner agreed. "What you should understand is that there's been odd stories coming from the direction of the Abbey for years. Rumors of the 6 suddenly recovering, the lame walking once again, that sort of thing."
He held up a hand as Clegg rolled his eyes.
"The locals don't take the stories too seriously. Like I said before, they consider the monks to be quiet, friendly neighbors who keep to themselves. Personally, I think the rumors stem from the libraries of medical knowledge they've gathered, along with every other book and map they can get their hands on."
Carla nodded. "I see what you mean. You get one monk who's been reading books on the medicinal values of plants for years, but all you see is him pulling a few weeds from the side of the road and brewing a tea from them that cures your daughter's cough. I can see how some might consider that a miracle."
"Exactly. The locals generally see it the way you do, but the rumors sometimes take root outside of Maipur. Every few months there's some folk who come in from the mainland or elsewhere, hearing about the Abbey and believing the rumors."
All right, a few desperate or curious trickling in, Kerla said, but a full pilgrimage?
Montrose shrugged. One of those rumors must have taken root in fertile soil. A few months ago, that trickle of believers coming into Maipur became a steady stream, almost all of them wearing the white clothes of triad pilgrims.
Kerla frowned. So what's going on with the road to the abbey? Why did you say it was unprofitable for bandits?
Most of the folk using the road now are pilgrims, and none of them have two coppers to rub together.
No profit, then, Clegg concluded.
Montrose shrugged.
You know about as much as I do now.
They settled into an uneasy silence as the carriage rattled through wide streets that sloped gently upward. Before long, the street they were on leveled out, and Kerla recognized the orphanage Montrose had pointed out to her from the launch. Three doors past that, the carriage stopped in front of an impressive townhouse, the Kohayan commissioner's flag hanging above the door. Kerla could see now that Montrose's home had originally been two townhouses, now merged together into a building twice the size of its neighbors. Two guards stood at the entrance. One of them trotted up to the carriage and opened the door for Montrose.
"Welcome back, sir."
"Thank you," Montrose told him.
He turned to take Kerla's hand as she stepped down from the carriage, then as the others gathered up their luggage, he led her up the stairs and into his home. They were met inside by a bright-eyed young man with a clipboard and a pencil.
"Welcome back, sir."
"Ah, Roger, just the man I was looking for. This young lady and her entourage need to be traveling out of the city today."
"Very good, sir. Horses and supplies, then. For how many?"
"Four."
"Yes, sir. And to whose account shall the bill be sent?"
"For now, Roger, bill it as a personal expense. Leave the receipts on my desk."
The clerk raised an eyebrow, but otherwise gave no reaction.
"As you wish, sir."
He nodded politely to Kerla and moved off towards the back of the townhouse. The front door opened again and Wick came in, carrying his and Kerla's bags, followed by the others. Kerla stepped up to him and took her bag back, slinging it over her shoulder.
"You can leave those down here if you like," Montrose offered.
"Not if that offer of a bath is still open," Kerla said. Montrose laughed and gestured for them to follow him upstairs. It was late morning before Kerla had finished her bath. There was a knock on the door as she was getting dressed.
"Yes," Kerla called out.
"Begging your pardon, mistress," came a young woman's voice, "but Master Brendan wanted me to tell you he's handling some business matters at the moment. He offers you the hospitality of his rooftop terrace, where lunch will be served shortly, and where he'll join you when he can."
"Thank you, I'll be right out."
The idea of lunch now appealed to her as much as the bath had, and she was curious about dining on a rooftop. Montrose wouldn't have built it if the view wasn't spectacular, she decided, based on her impression of the man. Taking a deep breath, she checked her reflection in the mirror to ensure her illusion was still in place. Then she slung her luggage over her shoulder and came into the hall. The maid curtsied to her.
"Right this way, miss," she said, leading Kerla down the hall and up another flight of stairs.
At the top was a large portrait of an attractive young woman with auburn hair and a bright smile. Kerla was struck, however, by the painting's frame. It was ornately carved, but painted black. It was a custom she recognized, but hadn't expected to see in Maipur. "They do that in the Quad," she thought, "painting a portrait's frame black to make it into a memoriam. Montrose might have been in Maipur for years, but he's still Kohayan at heart." "Excuse me," she asked when they reached the top of the stairs, "who is this?" The maid frowned, trying to remember.
"That's Brianna Montrose, mistress, Master Brendan's sister. Sorry, I didn't recall the name at first. She passed away some years back, long before I came to work here."
"Brianna," Kerla repeated, looking up at the woman. Yes, she could see the resemblance now. It was something in her smile. She'd seen it in Brendan's face as well.
"Thank you," she said to the maid. "Of course, mistress. The terrace is just this way."
They walked down another hall and up one more set of stairs that led to a comfortable parlor with very large windows, filling the room with sunlight. Patio doors opened from that room onto a wooden deck that extended to the front and the back of the house. Kerla saw Grievous was at the front, looking down into the bay with his telescope.
"There's a patio at the back of the house, mistress," said the maid. "That's where lunch will be served. Will there be anything else?"
"No, thank you," Kerla said.
The maid curtsied and descended the stairs. Grievous lowered his telescope and turned in her direction as Kerla approached.
"How's the view?" she called to him.
He smiled, looking relaxed and well-scrubbed himself.
"I am reminded of the view from His Grace's estate, though the view here is less dramatic."
dramatic. From the estate, you are looking down into Kohane, fully aware of gravity. Here, the view turns from vertical, he held one hand in front of him, fingers pointing upward, to horizontal. He tilted his hand 90 degrees, and Kerala instantly understood what he meant. In Kohane, the city was enclosed in the steep lagoon, the only view of the sea itself through the narrow gap of the Eisenteeth. Here, the horizon stretched out in front of them, the sun glittering on the wide bay. She pointed towards the northern side of the harbor. The cutlass was moored there, and it looked like there was a good deal of activity on board. Dutram's wasting no time starting repairs.
No captain wants to put off repairs to his ship, Grievous said with approval.
Did you enjoy your bath?
Grievous sighed.
A long-awaited pleasure, although the experience was something of a shock at first, he admitted. It was not until I removed my clothes that I realized your illusion affects my entire body, not just my face and hands.
Kerala laughed.
Then I expected the color to come off with the sponge, like an actor's makeup. Finally, I simply kept my eyes closed.
He gave her a slight smile.
A pity there is not time for washing our clothes so thoroughly as ourselves.
I was thinking that as well, she said, and it occurred to me that maybe I could come up with a spell to push the dirt out of the fabric. A modification of the repair spell... She broke off. No, no more modifications. No more mistakes.
Grievous's expression turned solemn as he regarded her. Then at last he spoke.
My wife was very fond of candles.
Kerala blinked in surprise. What?
Grievous smiled again.
I preferred oil lamps myself. The light was steadier, and the fragrances given off by her candles gave me a headache. I never told her, of course. I indulged her shamelessly.
Of course, Kerala said, still puzzled about Grievous's change of subject.
Thus, my children grew up in a household with candles everywhere, and I have not yet seen a child that can resist playing with a candle, have you?
No.
She knew Grievous had children, but she'd never heard him mention them before.
My daughter Placida was especially fascinated by them, Grievous went on. From the time she could walk, she would toddle towards any table that had a lit candle upon it. I would always warn her, stay back, do not touch. But my wife told me not to bother. What if she burns herself? I would ask. How else will she learn? Was her reply. Naturally, once Placida's arms were long enough to reach the candle, she put her hand in the flame and burned herself. Lesson learned.
He paused and looked at Kerala.
But which lesson?
Kerala frowned. I don't understand.
A child's curiosity, her drive to understand the world around her, is what compels her to reach for the fire. The real question is, after being burned, does she ever reach for anything again?
Kerala pursed her lips in irritation. All right, I see what you're talking about. You're saying that I've burned my fingers in regard to magic, is that it? Captain, men died on board the Cutlass through my mistake. I think I'm right to be more cautious when using it.
Grievous sighed.
Caution, as with all things, is best in moderation. During my career, I have had a great number of younger officers under my command. These officers were intelligent, resourceful, and confident, sometimes taking risks to accomplish their tasks. Invariably, these young officers would make mistakes, and when they did, it fell to me to discipline them. Some of them were so angry at themselves for the mistake, and so shamed by the rebuke they received, that they resolved never to take such risks again.
He shrugged.
So, they avoided any further punishments, but there was a price to be paid for such a safe course. It was their ambition and resourcefulness that had brought them this far. By turning away from that, their careers stagnated. The other officers, however, instead developed a greater understanding of how and when to take risks, and they continued to take them, now tempered with wisdom. They are the ones who went on to command ships of their own. They learned to respect the flame before they reached for the next candle. But they did not stop reaching.
His gaze became distant, unfocused, and he smiled.
Neither did Placida. She became a candlemaker, and her work is highly praised in Locus.
Kerala gave him a puzzled look. So what you're saying is... what are you saying?
You are a most resourceful person, he told her. Your ability to improvise and adapt to new problems is one of your greatest strengths. You are willing to take risks, using your wit to triumph in situations where others might have been too afraid to even try. One who lives in such a way will invariably make mistakes, and those mistakes will likely be bigger ones, or at least far more memorable ones, than those that others would make. She pointed down to the cutlass.
Well, that one's certainly memorable, she snapped. I should have known better.
How? Grievous asked, his own voice turning sharp. Who gave you the idea to modify your spell in the first place? That silenced her. Yes, Grievous said, the Agentes, and myself. We noticed the effect your magic was having on the cannon. We devised the theory. The fault is as much ours as yours. None of us knew what would happen. We sailed off the map together. The blame is not yours alone.
But I cast the spell, Carla threw back. I'm the only one who could do that.
Yes, and something went wrong, and your regret is to be expected. But those deaths are not yours to bear alone. You are not the only one nursing burned fingers. Grievous looked down at his hands. I allowed you to cast this enchantment upon me, despite knowing all too well what magic can do to a man. Why? He looked back up at her. Because you showed me that it was necessary for the mission to succeed, that to travel through this city undisguised would be foolhardy.
That's different, Carla objected. I'm not making any modifications to the illusion spell. I'm not making it up as I go along. It's when I try to make changes to the spells that things could go wrong. I can't risk any more experimenting with magic.
Grievous rubbed the bridge of his nose. Very well. If you will not take those risks for yourself, then consider the disservice you provide to His Grace.
His Grace?
You have allowed your fear of failure to keep you from grasping the true implication from that battle. Despite magic's interference, you can make gunpowder fire reliably. Any ship you are aboard becomes the most powerful in the freeze.
Carla went very still, the truth of Grievous's words crashing over her like a wave.
Which serves His Grace best, to never experiment with magic again, letting your fear dictate your actions, or to study this discovery, to learn from this mistake, and present him with your findings? How does the left hand answer that?
At length, Carla sighed. When you put it that way, there's only one answer, of course. She shook her head. I should have known better than to get into an argument with
a Sabrian, Grievous finished with a wry smile.
With a professor.
She smiled as Grievous chuckled and nodded at the compliment.
Well, I'll stop thinking about some magical way to clean my clothes, but you're right. I can't ignore what happened during the battle.
She gave a quiet laugh.
If nothing else, it'll be worth seeing the look on Galen's face when I tell him about it.
She looked up at Grievous.
Thank you, Captain. So, you're still willing to follow my lead?
Yes, the Sabrian told her. You were right about the disguise. Your instincts are sound. I only seek to help you do your job better. I have a personal interest in your success, do I not?
She smiled. That you do. We'll get that disguise off as soon as we're out of the city. Besides, it isn't as good as I hoped it would be.
Grievous looked amused. I have not seen any defects in your illusion, even after a bath.
No, it's not the spell, Carla explained. You still walk and talk like a Sabrian. Remember how Montrose reacted in the carriage when he first heard you speak? Before that, he didn't think you were anything other than what you appeared to be.
Grievous paused, looking thoughtful. I have noticed that when you are under one of these complete illusions, you do carry yourself differently. Your motions lack a certain fluidity. I had always thought it was some aspect of your magic, just part of the illusion. But it is not.
No, Carla told him, these spells only change how we look, not how we move or speak.
Grievous looked impressed. I commend your skill. To blend seamlessly into the background at need, to move among others without drawing attention to oneself. The Agentes taught you well.
Well, Tesca was the first to draw my attention to the fact that elves and humans move differently, Carla replied. But really, the one who taught me what to do was Galen. He would say that any disguise can fool the eye, but the perfect disguise fools its corner.
Grievous smiled in understanding. Ah, well put. You do not see details out of the corner of your eye, but you will pick up on things that are out of place, something that does not move as it should. This then draws your full attention.
That's it, she agreed. Elves move differently than humans. We have a fluidity, as you put it. Let's say you're looking out at a crowd of people in the street, not really focusing on any single person. But if one person is moving differently than the others, you'll notice.
Ripples in the water, Grievous said.
Yes, you may not be consciously aware of it or what it was that you noticed about them, but now that person is under your direct attention. Galen says once that happens, you've lost the first round. If there's anything else wrong with your disguise, the chances of your being discovered have increased tenfold. She gave Grievous a broad gesture, taking in his entire bearing. It's a very subtle thing, the way you carry yourself, less of a difference than the one between elves and humans. I actually noticed it first with Teska. It was easier to notice a northerner who moved like a Sabrian. Now that you're disguised, you're a ripple in the water to those who pay attention to such things, and when you actually speak, that's a splash.
Grievous chuckled. An interesting observation, my friend. I did not realize I was so poor at concealment.
Well, this is a different form of concealment than you may be used to, she assured him. Teska always said you were the hardest person to read he'd ever met. You're like a solid wall at times. You can't see what's behind it. But you'll notice a solid wall even out of the corner of your eye.
Ah, Grievous replied. I understand.
He gave her an amused grin.
A lifetime's habits are hard to break, especially a lifetime as long as mine. But I would be curious to learn how to, fool the corner of the eye, as you put it. One is never truly old so long as one still has new things to learn.
I'll be glad to help you with that. Perhaps you can teach me something as well, Kerla offered. Teska often remarked on your skill at sensing deception and concealment in others. He was teaching me himself, but... She trailed off. I need another teacher.
A vital skill for a left hand, Grievous agreed. Very well, let this be a bargain between us.
He offered her his hand, which she took.
What is my first lesson?
Don't rub the bridge of your nose. She grinned at his puzzled expression. You do that when you're tired or thinking, and Dutram's nose is a lot longer than yours. Your fingers go right through the illusion.
Grievous laughed as the parlor door opened. The maid came out, holding a large tray. She met Kerla's gaze and nodded towards the back of the house, then headed in that direction.
Ah, food!
The patio on the back of the house was a larger space than the viewing deck at the front, with enough room for a table and several wrought iron chairs. The view was in stark contrast to the front. Now they had the rising slopes of Maipur before them, revealing the buildings and streets in great detail. Below them, Montrose's lush garden took up much of the backyard, several of the trees nearly reaching the height of the roof.
"Will there be anything else, mistress?" the maid asked after she set down the tray, which held a platter of sandwiches, an assortment of cookies, a teapot, and four cups.
"No, everything looks wonderful," said Kerla with a smile. As an indication of his own appetite, Grievous had already selected a sandwich. "I suppose you could check on my other two companions and make sure they know we're up here." The maid curtsied.
"Certainly, mistress."
Grievous finished his first sandwich and took a second one as Kerla poured them both a cup of tea. He pointed west.
"There is the cathedral you are so fond of."
Kerla smiled at the sight of Daughter's Mercy rising over the tops of the buildings.
"These pilgrims the commissioner spoke of," Grievous went on, "would they be traveling to this place as well as the abbey? It is a similar religious edifice, is it not?"
"Well, I suppose we'd have seen them outside the cathedral as we drove past," Kerla said.
She shrugged and sipped her tea, then took a sandwich herself.
"I don't know much about pilgrims or what makes them choose one destination over another. Perhaps Montrose can answer that."
Grievous took a bite of his sandwich, frowning.
"You don't agree?"
Grievous seemed to make a decision as he chewed and swallowed.
"Let us have your first lesson before we are joined by anyone else. Are you aware that the commissioner is afraid of you?"
"Well, he was certainly nervous when he first met me," Kerla said, "but I think he's gotten over it."
Then she paused, remembering that Grievous wasn't there for that initial meeting. He hadn't seen Montrose's first reaction.
"You're saying he hasn't gotten over it?"
"He hides it well," Grievous said. "It took the entire carriage ride for me to be certain. But yes, he is quite afraid of you. He does not initiate eye contact with you, and if you catch his eye, he quickly breaks that contact."
She thought about it, absently chewing on her own sandwich. Grievous was right. She'd been too busy at the time to notice, but there had been something odd about Montrose's behavior. reviewing those events now, she began to see what Grievous was talking about.
"Perhaps he distrusts elves," Grievous offered.
"I don't think so," Carla said. "His reaction came before he knew I was an elf. It was when he learned I was the left hand." She described her first meeting with Montrose, Grievous listening with interest. When she had finished, Grievous remained silent for a few moments.
"So it appears that he does not fear you specifically, but rather you as the embodiment of his grace's wrath."
"I suppose," Carla said with a nervous laugh. She'd never been described as the embodiment of anything before.
"He was worried that I was here for him," Carla said, "as if he's up to something that he doesn't want the Duke to find out about."
"The way you describe these commissioners," Grievous said, "I would hazard that they are all involved in activities they would prefer others did not know about. But I believe you are correct."
"It would be interesting to find out what he's up to," Carla said, "but that's not what we're here for. Our plate's full as it is." Grievous nodded. "Can we trust him?"
The Sabrian shrugged. "There are many levels of trust. If I left a walking stick here, I would trust that he would keep it safe awaiting my return. But to guard my person while I sleep?" He chuckled. "If something were to happen to us while in my paw, I imagine the Duke would send someone to ask questions. They would naturally come to Montrose with those questions. Rationally, his best option would be to get us on our way as quickly as possible and minimize the likelihood of us stumbling upon what he is trying to hide."
"Rationally," Carla agreed, "but men in the grip of fear aren't always rational, are they? Everything we know about what's going on here or at the Abbey is based on what Montrose has told us. I think that's a greater level of trust than we should extend to him at this time." Grievous nodded in agreement. "We need a second opinion."
"And where shall we find one in this city?" Grievous asked.
She was thinking about that when the parlor door opened and Clegg and Wick both came out. The cook's wispy white hair was sticking out in all directions, hastily and inefficiently toweled dry. Wick grinned at the food on the table as he walked over to them.
"That's a nice view up here," the guard said, "but I'm too hungry to see much beyond this."
Clegg didn't waste time on words. He'd already stuffed one sandwich into his mouth and had picked up two more before he looked around the table, frowning.
"Just tea," he muttered, his mouth still full. "Thought you said there'd be wine, at least."
Suddenly, Carla had an idea. "Never mind the wine, Clegg. That tavern you were talking about before, the one with the cinnamon rum?" Clegg stopped chewing as he turned to look at her. "Could you find it again?" The cook grinned eagerly at her as he resumed chewing. Carla sensed Grievous's puzzlement and looked up at him with a smile. "Second opinion." This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.